My book, The Spirit of Work, Timeless Wisdom, Current Realities, is now published. By interweaving science, business, and sacred texts from the world's great spiritual traditions, The Spirit of Work offers a high-level but approachable way to view and structure work from individual, community, and institutional perspectives. As part of the book's reach and outreach, I will be adding some solo podcasts and interviews with authors who write to build healthy workplaces. To give you a taste of how the book's concepts can enhance your workplace experience, to get to the Spirit of Work links and purchase from online stores directly, click on the online store of your choice from my website, which is shiftworkplace.com/thespiritofwork. Make sure you put hyphens in between the words The Spirit of Work to ensure the correct URL comes up. So that's shiftworkplace.com/thespiritofwork with hyphens. And that's how you'll get to your goal. Looking forward to your feedback. Hello, Culture and Leadership Connections podcast listeners. Today, I'm very excited to present to you Rain Martin, who is the founder and leadership coach at It's the Impact. She has a most interesting story, which I very much identified with because we both wanted to change the world from the time we were young. And as she says that at a young age, she was interested in making the world a better place for everyone. And at age 12, she staged a boycott against worksheets because they weren't teaching her friends. Worksheets are not usually a really holistic learning experience. So that's interesting that she did that. And in high school, she demanded school officials provide her classmates with the college entrance exam and stood with her Black friends when they spoke out against the fact that the school had a Black and a white beauty pageant, and she thought it should be integrated. She had a vision for a world that was equitable and diverse from the time she was a child, and she has continued that up to this day. During Rain's 25 years of executive experience in government and nonprofit organizations, she held many titles and directly led organizations with hundreds of employees and million-dollar services, and led an award-winning coalition to reshape statewide education legislation to design and ensure that children, regardless of race and social class, received a high-quality education. She created and scaled an innovative effort dedicated to ending inhuman housing relocation processes and brought vital services back to a neighborhood that had been neglected for 20 years, building the first of its kind school district after a natural disaster. Wow. I'm just thinking the entire concourse on high and is cheering for you. So she uses her experience and unique strengths to help leaders dig deeper into their purpose and vision, fine-tune their strategies, overcome mindset blocks, and build the pathway to success in their big, audacious dreams to see a better world for everyone. Wow, Rain Martin, you are a woman after my own heart. I'm so happy to meet you and to host you on our podcast. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. It's good to have that appreciation around the work, and I'm excited to be here as well today.
A lot of times people look at the kind of work that you might do and say, oh, that's so idealistic, but I'm sure you have a great answer for that, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, it's not idealistic. It's necessary, would be my basic answer. You know, I have a saying I like to put out there to folks that you aren't leading if you're not using your leadership to make a more just and equitable world.
Exactly.
And to me, it's the same skills and things that you would do in any other environment. It's just directing and harnessing it all to creating a better world for those of us that are never going to get the access to sit in the seats that we get to sit in.
Yes. And without vision, the people perish.
That is correct.
You never get anywhere if you don't have an ideal and you don't have a vision of where you're going to go. And your vision of having an equitable world drives your activities because it keeps you motivated.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I believe that truly every leader, once they're dialed into their purpose and knows why they're here, has the actual capacity to do this kind of work. So I don't think it's idealistic. I think we live in a society that's mostly driven by capitalism. And so people look at this kind of work as idealistic, but really it's actually fully capable and accessible to all of us.
It is. It is. So tell the audience a little bit more about who you are and what you do from the personal perspective.
Yeah, so I grew up in a very small rural town in North Louisiana, about 200 people, and really impoverished upbringing. My dad painted houses. My mom did different odd jobs here and there. I was the oldest of four kids. We slept in the same bedroom until I was about 12. My brother and sister and I slept in sleeping bags on the floor of my parents' bedroom, except in the summer. In the summer when it was hot, we got to sleep on the screened-in porch. And I was able to get myself to college as far away as I could, which was for me about an hour north. It was a small liberal arts college. And at that point, I realized just how poor we actually were when I was applying for college assistance. You know, I realized that our household income was about $18,000 for a house of six. So got myself, like I said, as far away as I could. A lot of people in my town, including my guidance counselor, really put the heavy pressure on not to go to school there. She actually said, well, I actually don't know that you're smart enough to spend that amount of money on college. And you're going to, you know, perhaps regret it because you're going to owe a lot of debt. And I'm not sure that you're actually going to be able to do much with that college degree. So it was a great upbringing, but it had its challenges.
Yeah. Sure. Well, you sure proved that guidance counselor wrong, didn't you?
I did.
You know, I had a similar experience when I was in grade two. The teacher told my mother that I would never make it through school and certainly never through university. And I often wish that if she were still alive, I'd like to go and take my doctoral degree and say, hey, you said I would not make it through school or university. And I think I've done it.
Yeah, more so. And can you, I mean, it's just so infuriating. I mean, honestly, when I hear that story and I think, who would tell a seven-year-old, because that's essentially the age that you are, such a thing, right? People in those roles have a lot of power over what happens in people's lives. And it honestly, it infuriates me to hear things like that. I'm sorry that happened to you, to be honest.
Well, I think for people who develop grit and resilience like yourself, those kinds of things are temporary or momentary setbacks because your vision keeps you going forward and you also maybe have a stronger desire to prove other people wrong when they don't believe in you. I don't know. Is that true of you?
I did a speech recently to a number of women business leaders about, and it was on purpose. And I really connected my own purpose to the story of my mom. And it was the same with my friends growing up. It didn't necessarily make me feel like, oh, I'm going to prove you wrong. But it really pissed me off on behalf of my friends. Mm-hmm. And my mom had a similar set of experiences growing up where she was never believed in and even told she was nothing by her own mother. And so those stories definitely brought me to where I am today. Nothing makes me more angry or fuels my fire more than being able to give people opportunities to see their own brilliance and their own amazingness, particularly people who just don't have that infrastructure and systems in place to show them at young ages. So I do think it's made me who I am without a doubt.
You're just reminding me of a memory that I have of a 15-year-old young man who is a refugee from Sierra Leone who said to me, just because we're poor doesn't mean we can't solve the problems in our communities.
Absolutely.
I thought that was a brilliant statement. It just stuck with me.
Yeah. In fact, one could argue they're more equipped.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So can you share a couple of incidents from that childhood you referred to just a minute ago that you believe made you into that person you are today?
I mean, I would definitely say that growing up poor was a fundamental factor and growing up in rural Louisiana and in a good and a not so good way. So I'll give one of the maybe not so good ways. You know, we had a 1957 pickup truck. It was light baby blue with a white top. And once a month, we would all get in that cab of that truck and we would drive and go get groceries every month. And it was, you know, a big deal. It was our time to go into town. We all got to pick like one thing we wanted. I would always get Doritos. That was always my thing. And it was a fun experience. But looking back, that experiences and other experiences I had really created a world for me where I spent a number of years just living in a scarcity mindset. Right? Like not realizing that from a monetary perspective and from a relational perspective, that things could be abundant and available to me. And what that did, I think, is shaped a world where I was very successful, but through a lot of anxiety and through a lot of hardship, I pushed myself and sort of convinced myself that things needed to be harder than they actually needed to be in order to get places that I wanted to get in life. So at 48, I feel like I finally, you know, in my mid 40s, I'm shifting that quite a bit and letting the idea that I can just be and that just by virtue of being and not necessarily having to work extra hard or think that things aren't going to be available to me, that I can still be successful and still have things. So I would say that's one particular experience.
So the experience of going monthly to buy and buying Doritos, But that was an enjoyable experience for you and it was an outing. But can you think of an incident when you felt that there was this scarcity that you couldn't get past when you were a child? Did you experience that as a child or as a teenager, perhaps?
Yeah, I think what got interesting about it is that as I got older, so I had my first job at 14 and my first job was picking blueberries. And I would get up at 5:30 in the morning to be dropped off by my dad on his way to paint houses before it got super hot. And I would be out there for about 4 hours and make my own money. And what started happening was my parents would say, okay, we're going to go to the grocery store. If you want something extra, you buy it with your own money, right? And so then I added paste picante sauce to my Dorito purchase because I love spicy hot sauce, right? So I would say it didn't feel painful in the moment. It felt like, I get to buy something for myself. But those experiences, again, contributed to a world where I felt like everything I needed or wanted to have in life, I really had to fight for. I really had to put in extra effort for.
I see.
And that stayed with me a long time. I mean, I was known as the one who'll work. You know, my dad would say, well, you're not the smartest, you know, but you'll work the hardest. And it was those experiences of not having anything and having to get it for myself that were a blessing and a curse mm-hmm. as I got older.
Mm-hmm. What about when you became a young adult or you said you went to college? Did you have any formative experiences that you think really shaped you at that point?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I like to say, because I'm from a small rural town, I was radically undereducated. So I remember getting to college and being surrounded mostly by private and religious school students, mostly people with money. And I was the first from my town to go to this particular college. And I went to English class and immediately got a crush on my English teacher. That's a whole different story we won't share today. But I remember doing really bad in my English classes and being asked by the English teacher to stay after class. And, you know, I'm thinking in my little, you know, mind, oh, you know, I get to hang out with my cute teacher, right? Nothing more, pretty innocent in that regard, but just, oh, you know, he's cute. I get to hang out. And what I realized is I was in a remedial course of one that no one really wanted to call me out because in my college, there wasn't such a thing as remedial. You know, you had money, you made good grades, and you got yourself there. It was sort of selective in that way. And at that moment, I realized I was the salutatorian of my high school. So I was second in grades. I had won all these awards, all these scholarships, and yet I got to college and couldn't pass a basic English course. And so that was really fundamental for me as well to make sure that a lot of my time in my professional career has been to fighting for kids to have really great educational opportunities, regardless of the circumstance they grew up in.
Yeah, that's a great story because you overcame it. Obviously, you developed writing skills or you wouldn't have gotten through college, right?
I did, but I would say, you know, lasting impact to that. I mean, I spent most of my life thinking I was dumb.
Yeah.
You know, both the having to work hard to get what I needed and being undereducated. And I mean, look, in college, I was known as sort of a crazy study girl because I would party. I would definitely hang out and party, but I would bring posters to parties with my study notes. You know, I would be the friend that stayed out till 3 with the rest of her friends and was up at 6:30 working. So it unfortunately in some way fueled this notion I had for a couple decades of myself that really I wasn't smart. I just could outwork everyone.
Well, the plus side is that you developed discipline and a work ethic and you strove towards meeting your goals. And then the downside would be that you overworked things out of a sense of inadequacy, right?
So that's right. You're exactly right. I couldn't have said it better.
So from the groups you were born into, what would you say has most influenced your sense of culture and self as a leader now?
I would say that growing up, because I do identify in a way, I mean, right now, in my life, you know, I do fairly well income wise and I'm around people who do fairly well. And, you know, in this culture, in our country right now, things are so polarized. And I live in a liberal city. I live in New Orleans. And I find that one of the ways I think I'm different based on how I grew up and the identity of being poor and rural is I'm able to really understand more parts of our country and parts of our thinking that a lot of people who I associate with now refuse to or don't want to, right? You know, conservative beliefs is what people might normally call them here. I don't believe in them. And I work with my friends to try to open their mind about these things. But what makes me unique, I think, based on my upbringing, is I understand how they got to where they got based on where we grew up and based on what we saw, based on what we had access to and what we didn't have access to. Mm-hmm. So I'm always proud of that. I'm always proud that I'm not willing to just cut people off based on their beliefs. And I think that's largely because of the way that I grew up and the people that I learned to appreciate, regardless of the different views that they may have had.
Right. Poverty in your immediate family, I'm sure, were very formative. But Louisiana has a culture too. Of course, there's many, many, many cultures, and every area has its own regional sense of place. But that would be something that would have influenced you, I would think. You obviously had a strong sense of race and wanting to be of assistance to and promote equity. And that could have been just a personal orientation, but it might have come from a group that you were born into too, or, you know, maybe your family was like that, or you may have had, you know, religious influences or other kinds of influences that you grew into, you know, even just the culture of your father painting houses. So any of those come to mind?
One of the fundamental experiences I had when I was younger, so on Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, so we weren't very religious. What's interesting is that we lived in this small town that had a very distinctive culture, right? Religious, conservative, mostly white. But my mom was from upstate New York. We didn't really have any family there. And where all of my friends, they were on 10th generations, right? We didn't go to church. So what's kind of interesting is that we were sort of the amusing outcasts in some way. Like, people liked us. They thought we were interesting. My mom had, she's one of 12. She had a gay brother. So people were like, oh, we know a person who has a gay family member, right? So we were different in that way. And we didn't go to church, which was remarkable, except on Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, my mom took us to the Black church in town. And I remember how welcome we were. I mean, it was like the most abundant display of love and appreciation maybe I've ever seen, even to this date in my life. And I know that that experience and other experiences that my mom brought from a different part of the country into our small little home in rural Nowhereville, Louisiana, did definitely have an impact on my need to fight for an equitable world. Yeah,
that's a lovely memory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it really is.
Yeah, it's great. It's the idea that your mother, in spite of the difficult circumstances, went out of her way to expose her children to something that would help them see and experience how important it was to work together with people across difference. And at the same time, willing to take them into a place where they might feel uncomfortable because it would be unusual for them. And yet, at the opposite happened, you felt warmly welcomed. I remember this story by Eric Clapton, who said that his favorite memory when he was a young musician was just going and playing in the Black clubs because he had such a warm welcome and everybody took him in as a brother, whereas everywhere else it was like, yeah, prove yourself. Yeah, I think it's a similar story to what you just said.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I remember my best friend, Tanya, we knew each other since we were five because I went to the same school, kindergarten through 12th grade. So I, you know, all my friends had known since I was 5 years old, and she came over. We would call each other sisters, and her mom brought her over, and her mom wouldn't come in the house at first. And my mom said, well, you know, invite your mom in. And it was the first time that any white person had ever invited her into their house. And we're talking the 80s, right? Mm-hmm. This is not in the 70s or 50s or, you know. So I definitely credit my mom with giving me that perspective where I would not have gotten it any other way where I grew up.
Wow, that's beautiful. So then what about groups you chose to belong to? Because you have had a lot of groups in your life that you joined and became a part of. So what aspects of those groups have you taken with you and it's become part of who you are now?
Yeah, I would say I've become more self-identified as a woman leader. And as a leader, I would often be called, you know, the typical negative names that a woman leader would be called. And I think that was partly because I was operating in my own way, but also because I was adaptive to a style of leadership that was more male-centered. And I really didn't think much about it. I didn't really consider myself a woman leader, even though growing up, my dad used to constantly be sexist about things. I remember when G.I. Jane, the movie, came out, and my dad was so mad about that movie. We got in a big, huge fight about it, right? But even despite that, I never thought of myself as like a woman leader. I was just a leader. And then I came back to my home state. I had been gone for 10 years and started leading here in my early to mid 30s. And started noticing that, like, I was literally just dismissed, like completely looked over, not thought of in any sort of real kind of way. And at that point, dug in even more around the more classic male-oriented leadership styles. And I'm happy that in my 40s, you know, with the movements like Me Too and others, really just became much more in touch with who I wanted to be as a leader, as a woman. And I'm proud that I feel at this point, like I can say, no, I'm a woman leader. And as a woman leader, you know, I'm still getting things done, but I'm getting things done in a way that feels more connected with my own skills and strengths.
Yeah. So really, I guess it's coming into your own. You've been very other focused. And yes, then possibly this association with others has allowed you to come into your own individually as well.
Absolutely. And I think what's happening in the world is sort of allowing for that in a way. And, you know, I feel like right now we're in a world where there's more permission to truly be who you are. And so that's one thing I just would like to encourage everybody is, like, you know, whoever you feel like you are, whatever groups you really want to associate with, do that now more than ever. It's nice to see the world starting to create more space for that.
I want to dig a little deeper to see about something you may have changed or wanted to change. Like, I have had a lot of experience with Persian culture, and the way people greet each other and the way they show respect and hospitality is really beautiful. And I have tried consciously to adopt it over the years into my life. And I think I am, for the most part, successful, but I keep running into glitches every once in a while where I realize I haven't completely adopted it. And perhaps that's also good to differentiate and to say which pieces work for you and which don't. So, for example, when I greet people, I will ask them about their families and about their health, and always make a very conscious eye contact and warm greeting, which I didn't do until I had met enough Persians to say, you know, this is a really nice way to greet people. Now, at the table, when you're serving, you never eat unless everybody else has been served first and you eat last. And yet, if I don't always do that, because if I'm, for example, the person who has to get up 20 times or have a meeting to go to and I don't have much time to eat, I'll go, okay, I just need to serve myself. And here you go, help yourselves. And then I think, oh, that's probably really insulting to the persons at the table right now because it's not showing proper service, hospitality, attitude, right? But I feel conscious of it, but I don't feel that I need to change it because of my circumstances. But has there been something that you tried to adopt into the way you do things?
I would say my version of that really is different and the same. And what I am constantly on a quest about is to be a fully aware white person in the world who's operating with a high level of privilege, right? And so I've always been the minority around in all the environments I've worked in, and, you know, always been completely comfortable with that and preferred it, to be frank. But back in my early professional years, the version of being a white person who was promoting equity looked different than it does now. And it involved me doing things sometimes like, and I forget there's a word for it, but speaking a certain way that is traditionally held among my Black female friends, right? To be cool, to be inclusive. Well, now, you know, in my 40s, as I continue to evolve, I learned that that actually is not respectful, right? To basically try to sort of adopt just a way of behaving because it's a cultural appropriation. Sorry, that's the terms for it, right? Or to another example would be, instead of before, where I might say, here's my opinion, now let me make sure that I'm asking, you know, all of the people of color their opinions on my team. Now I recognize that not only is there a power that I hold by being the leader, but that there's an informal power of my opinion as a white female meaning more. So now I don't even want to give my opinion.
Right.
So I would say my version of that right now is really around trying to continue to operate as someone who recognizes that their privilege exists and tries to minimize it as much as possible in a way that is truly beneficiary and respectful to all of the populations and cultures I get to engage in. And that I take very seriously. I have a very diverse client base. It is the number one priority of my business. So it's something that really matters to me generally.
It's a constantly expanding awareness to be aware mm-hmm. of privilege and to negotiate it. There are lots of nuances in it, wouldn't you say?
Oh, without a doubt. You know, I still make mistakes, you know, and luckily I have a diverse enough set of friends that are true friends that are willing to point it out for me. And I know so many people who are white and privileged that don't have that.
Or wouldn't be open to it.
Oh, absolutely. Part of why they don't have it is because they're not open to it, you know, and that becomes a whole nother interesting battle about, you know, how do you help influence those people in your own network that aren't even close to where you are in your own journey in a way that is accepting for them, but also kind of puts them on point a little bit.
Well, once you name something, then you become a part of both the problem and the obligation to be part of the solution. And so as long as you keep denying the name, you can stay in your own bubble.
That's right. Such well put. I love that.
So how would you say your temperament and personality affect the way you see the world? Because temperament is, you know, you see kids and from the time they're little, they're quiet and reflective, or they're really outgoing and bubbly, and you just see that's part of who they are. But then they develop personality based on other kinds of things that happen to them and how they respond to those things, opportunities missed or opportunities gained. So what were you born with temperament-wise, and what have you added on personality-wise?
Oh, gosh, that's such a great question. Do people actually know the answer to that?
They sometimes do. Sometimes they do.
That's fascinating. I mean, I know that I've had quite a similar personality for a pretty long time and that it's pretty consistent. One of the things that most people, if you look at like, okay, what are typical words people would describe you as over your years from a variety of places? Authentic is a huge one I get all the time, right? And so what that means is I show up with opinions. I'm not afraid to say them. I am someone who will confront injustices, immoralities. And as long as I can remember, that's been the case. So I don't know how I might have been born different. I mean, what's also perhaps interesting about me that I really didn't think about until, you know, these sorts of questions is I was raised by a stepdad. My biological dad was not around, and I see him maybe once every 10 years or so, and I didn't know him. So I think sometimes there's maybe a void there on the answer to that question. There's a significant part of who I am that maybe I just don't even know. Interesting fact, I saw him a couple of weeks ago, and he met my family for the first time and informed me that his mother was 100% Ukrainian, which I had no idea. So I'm sort of fascinated now with this idea that I'm Ukrainian and have yet to discover what I want to do about that, but I want to do something. The other interesting fact there that I'll say, because this is just so interesting, and your question of nurture versus nature. So I have two children and they're both stepchildren. I do not have my own children. So I sometimes am just so thankful for my stepfather who raised me, who most people in our town did not know he was my stepfather. In fact, he tried to adopt me, for giving me a model of what parenting can look like, because my children feel like I'm their real parent, and I am. And I do think that's very credited to my dad and what he gave me as a young person.
That's a lovely answer. I really appreciate that answer. I think it's deeply reflective.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate the question, because honestly, it's a good prompt to me to go dig a little deeper on this question of culture. I feel really rooted in the associations I have with rural and with poverty and women, but I don't in terms of a cultural identity. So I'm going to use this interview as a way to kind of dig a little deeper there. I appreciate it.
Well, culture is any groups, really. But often whatever people grow up in that's the dominant culture, it becomes normalized to them, and they don't see it as cultural. They see it as normal. So when we stop seeing our own culture as normal, but see it from the outside as just a way of being that comes from association with a group, then we have new insights, which is actually my next question. So a time that you felt you had cultural dissonance, you went into a situation and you felt like, wow, this is the way people do things different from me. But you mentioned it when you talked about going to the Black church on Martin Luther King Day. So that's one, but I'm sure you've had many others.
Yeah. So this is even more lately. So this is maybe, again, fascinating because maybe it's a slightly different than what we'd expect, but maybe not based on what you just defined as culture. So I get really uncomfortable when I'm around lots of people that have lots of resources, people that I characterize as privileged. So my husband recently has wanted to join the yacht club here, the sailing club, which I said, okay, you know, fine. If that's important to you, that works. And I noticed that, again, of all the people I might go in a room with or feel uncomfortable with, that is one of the top ones. And it's partly my own uncomfortability, and it's partly a bias that I need to work through because it's sort of how I've characterized in my own story what those people are or are not about. And to be honest, I haven't really given them the opportunity to prove that they are or not about those things. But to your point about how we grow up in our culture, you know, I didn't make that leap until now, but growing up the way that I did, it makes sense that that would be a group of people I would be uncomfortable with and that I would have a certain bias.
Social class is a culture.
Mm-hmm.
And there are social markers. So the restaurants you might go to, the foods you choose to eat, the way you speak, the way you walk, all of those things are social markers to people, and they're greetings that everybody uses to identify their people in the social class. And then when you move out of that to a different social class setting, the markers are not the same. It feels as if you were dumped in a country that you've never been to before where the language is different. You have that same kind of disconnect. So I think that was a great example.
Wow. Thank you. Well, it helped me that you asked that question. It might be why I still insist on going to the Goodwill in town and the dollar store. It's like, I love a good purchase at the Goodwill, you know? And honestly, I'm embarrassed to tell my mom or other people if I spend full price on something. And I can easily see as you're posing these questions, how that could be attached to my cultural upbringing.
Yeah, this feeling of social class disconnect can be very powerful. The first time I experienced it was when I went to France with my husband, who was then my fiance, and I met his relatives. Now, all my relatives were refugees from Eastern Europe. You know, there was no connection and there was no family similar to yours. His relatives are all really embedded geographically, both on his dad's side and on his mom's side. His mom's side, the aristocratic family in France, and that started the Industrial Revolution in southern France. So the first place we went to was in Paris, and it was an apartment where he had a great aunt and great uncle. And they had a Portuguese maid who wore a little lace apron and a lace hat. And the incident that stands out in my mind is that when the great aunt would want something from the maid, even if the maid was standing right next to her, she would get up, go and get her little bell, sit down, then ring the bell.
Oh, my goodness.
And then maid roll her eyes and go, yes, madam, what can I get for you? When she could have just looked at her and said, would you mind getting me the salt? She never, she never looked at the maid. And it was such a clear social marker. And it absolutely shocked me. I could hardly participate for the 4 days that we were there in anything because I just felt so shocked by everything around.
Yeah, I can totally identify. We'd have had the exact same. We were at a place recently where, again, you know, at least in my own bias, the social marker was higher than what I'm familiar with growing up. And my husband and I were there, and there was a plastic cup on the ground, and it kept getting kicked by everyone. Like, people would literally walk it and kick it, like, and move it. And everyone knew it was a large plastic loud cup. My husband and I looked at each other, and, you know, in my thinking, it's like, yeah, do people not think they're good enough here to pick up a cup? And, you know, you got to be careful with someone recognizing bias. Maybe that was or wasn't it, but it's certainly my own narrative to go there very quickly. You know, the other thing that I don't know if this has happened to you, but the other thing I notice is that as I've moved into different socioeconomic groups, I feel guilty. And there's certain things that I don't feel comfortable people knowing because I just feel guilty about the fact that I might be somewhere that other people aren't. So that can definitely plague me quite a bit.
All interesting things to consider. So we're getting close to the end of the interview now. And when you are working with somebody or hiring someone or someone's hiring you, what would you tell them about what brings out the best in Rainn Martin?
You know, I love a leader who's down for a cause. I mean, really, it's like brings me light. I want to do everything I can to absolutely help them. Like I said, I believe you're not leading unless you're making a difference for the world. So I have learned now in being business for 8 years that unless you are that person, you're not really going to be a good match for me. So I would say that that's really what it is. Let's get in there and get dirty and get brave and be authentic and really fight for something that you can justifiably know that you left an impact in a positive way in this world. It jazzes me up like nothing else.
Mm-hmm. So good to know that about yourself and also for other people to know that about you.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you'd like to say or promote? This is your chance.
I would say, you know, for any leader out there, I do think there aren't as many programs as there should be for leaders who actually are trying to make a difference. That's why we specialized in that with It's the Impact. We have a great program called The Changemaker, and it is a full comprehensive leadership support system. It includes one-on-ones. It includes what I've trademarked as the four C's of changemaking, and it includes group work as well, because, you know, you need someone who's there to help you be vulnerable and push through the blind spots on a one-on-one. And then also when you're doing this work to change the world, there's nothing like a good community of people who are also doing that work to help. So anybody out there that's looking for, you know, really know that they're making an impact and to do it in a collective community of others, look us up. It's The Impact, The Changemaker. We're happy to open our arms and embrace you and help you change the world.
That's great. We'll put all of those links into the show notes so that people can connect with you.
Thank you.
It's important for people when they want to do anything that requires an effort to have a community around them. So that's wonderful that that's what you provide. And the model sounds like a really solid way for people to move forward.
Thank you. Well, you know, I never thought about it to your questions, but I guess we're creating a culture where it's okay to be that kind of leader.
Yeah. Too. Not just okay, but actually highly cherished.
Yeah. Thank you.
So I really appreciated this interview, this time with you, and sharing a little bit about your world and your life and your organization, which sounds so important, and the work that you're doing sounds like it is something that needs to be embraced really on an international scale. And I wish you all success with that. And I'll be following your work with interest.
No, thank you. I know I've said this before, but I am absolutely in love with your podcast and your topic. And these are conversations that so many more people should be having. And I just feel really privileged and special that I get to be part of this and that I found you. And I just appreciate what you're doing, sincerely.
Well, you are special. That's why you're featured on the podcast. And welcome to the Culture and Leadership Connections community.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rain. You have a wonderful rest of your day.
You too.
Rain Martin has been dedicated to making the world a better place since she was a child. With the social justice mindset from her mother, the nurturing care from her stepfather, and the experience of overcoming a life of poverty, she has now come into her own. Continuous dedication to promoting a more just and equitable world has brought her into contact with many marginalized groups, where she served as an ally and a catalyst for real change to the tune of improved housing, education, and better life opportunities. It was a real pleasure to interview Rain, whose organization supports leadership changemakers with a surrounding community and resources that build an ecosystem for addressing the real problems of our communities. If you enjoyed this episode, I encourage you to press the share button as soon as you can and send it to someone for whom it could make a real difference. I leave you with my sincere wish that culture and leadership connections continue to guide and inspire your day. Hey, podcast listeners, help us reach our goal of 1,000 downloads per episode by going to followthepodcast.com/culture and leadership. That's followthepodcast.com/culture and leadership. If you type that into your browser and you use the and sign, not the word and, culture and leadership, it will automatically adjust to your phone. And then you can follow and rate. So followthepodcast.com/culture and leadership. Thanks in advance for following and for reviewing.